I have a story to tell you. One of the prominent rabbis of Southern California is Rabbi Eli Shochet, who was for many years a rabbi out in the western part of the San Fernando Valley. But before he was a prominent rabbi at a synagogue in the San Fernando Valley, he was a little kid growing up in Chicago. And when Eli Shochet grew up in Chicago, it was a rough and tumble place in the 30s. And he grew up in a rough and tumble part of Chicago. His father before him was a rabbi, and his grandfather before him was a great traditional rabbi. Eli tells a story from a time when he was about 8 or 9 years old, when on Shabbat afternoon he was playing outside of his Zadie's house, and a great big black Cadillac pulled up in Chicago in the 1930s. And out of that great big Cadillac appeared two burly big guys wearing very elegantly tailored suits with very large coats over those elegantly tailored suits and a suspicious bulge in the front chest area of those coats. They got out of the car, they went to the back of the car, they opened up the back door, and out of that Cadillac emerged one of the most notorious Jewish gangsters of Chicago in the 30s. He walked up the steps to the rabbi's house, knocked on the door, didn't wait to be answered, opened the door and walked in, pulling out of his pocket a thick envelope stuffed with bills. And he took that wad of money and he put it on the table in front of the rabbi, and he said, "Nem for de yeshiva kinder, zitz mein mama's yahrzeit." For those of you who don't speak Farsi, it's for the yeshiva kids, it's my mother's yahrzeit, the anniversary of her death. And then, without another word, he turned, walked out of the rabbi's house, and drove away. And little Eli Shochet was furious. He was furious at the nerve of this man who would desecrate the Sabbath so brazenly in front of his grandfather, driving up in a car, coming with guys who are loaded with weapons, bringing money for the rabbi on Shabbos. Can you imagine? And he was furious at his Zadie. How could his grandfather tolerate that kind of display of power and brutality and vulgarity? For years, he nursed his rage, and at one point he asked his Zadie, "How could you have let that happen?" And his Zadie said, "This man has led a brutal, criminal life his entire adult life. And one day, in the midst of the routine of the violence and the degradation and the horror, he looked at the calendar and he suddenly remembered it was his mother's yahrzeit. And the memory of his mother's yahrzeit, that single moment, made him remember her dreams for him. She hadn't dreamed for him to be a gangster. She had dreamt that he would grow up to be a good Jew, a mensch, someone respectable, someone who would contribute to making the world a better place." And Eli's grandfather said, for that one pure moment, the man wasn't a gangster. He was suddenly his mother's son, wanting to live her dream. So he took a wad of money, he got in a car, he drove over to a rabbi's house, and he made a contribution. Yes, on Shabbos. But he did it because for a moment he wanted to be the man his mother had dreamed of. Just for a moment. We all have such moments of clarity, such moments in which We live so truly that if we lived only for that moment, it would be sufficient. The great Hasidic master, Reb Yechiel of Zlotchkov, wrote in the Likutim Yikarim, "There are times when you are in an ordinary state of mind and you feel that you cannot draw near to God. But then, in an instant, the light of your soul will be kindled and you will go up to the highest worlds. You are like one who has been given a ladder. The light that shines in you is a gift from above." One of my favorite Jewish prayers, favorite Jewish songs, is Dayenu. Dayenu, it would be enough. Had God only liberated us from slavery and not brought us to the sea, Dayenu. Had God brought us to the sea and not made the sea part, Dayenu. A moment of such transcendent purity that nothing else is necessary. Dayenu, it's sufficient. I have a second story to share. And to do that, I have to give you a little background. I am the father of two 15-year-old twins. Yes, I know you're thinking, how can a man of such buoyant youthfulness possibly be the father of... But I am. My children are wonderful human beings. Shira and Jacob, both full of idiosyncrasies that I assume they get from their father's side, and full of beauty and goodness and purpose that they get from their mothers. And one other detail I need to share. My son Jacob has been wrestling with autism his entire life. And he is a hero in the tenacity and the determination and the strength he brings to that struggle each and every day of his life. And his sister is a hero in her devotion to her brother and her patience and her love and her sweetness. Since the children were infants, we have taken them to Camp Ramah. In fact, every single year of their life, they have been Ramah campers. They first went to family camp, which was held Memorial Day weekend. From the time they were 6 months old on, they have been to Passover Institute, and from the moment Shira was old enough to go to camp, there was no question but that she was going, and there was no question where she was going. And for years, Jacob has grieved over the fact that his sister could be a camper at Camp Ramah, and he couldn't. Camp Ramah has a wonderful program, Amitzim, for special needs kids, but up until this year, the kids were not allowed to bring an aide. So only those children who were able to participate in the camp without a personal aide were able to be there. This year, for the first time, Camp Ramah changed their policy, and they allowed the children to come with an aide, which meant that for the first time, Jacob was able to fulfill what he says is a lifelong dream of being able to be a camper at Camp Ramah while his sister was a camper at Camp Ramah. And the timing was pretty good because this year she was in Machon, which for those of you who don't know the inner code of Ramah, Machon is the oldest group of campers. After that, you spend the summer in Israel with USY Ramah, and then if you're among the lucky chosen few, you come back as a CIT. So Jacob was either going to do it this summer or miss it entirely. But thank God the camp changed their policy and they allowed him to come with an aide. So Jacob was there for a week with his aide, and he says it was the best week of his life. And that's not the story I want to tell you. Every summer that Shira has gone as a camper, she has allowed me to go as camp rabbi for a week. And as the summers have progressed, she's added rules to my being the camp rabbi. So when she was around 12, she told me, no more cute Shira stories. The year after that, she told me there was an additional rule, and that was I was not allowed to make eye contact with her. Although I was supposed to always respond when she made eye contact with me. Last year, she banished me entirely. She was 14 after all, and who wants their dad hanging around camp? But this year, being a mature 15-year-old, she decided it was okay for me to come back for one grand finale as camp rabbi. And she also realized that if I was camp rabbi the final week of the last session, then she didn't have to take the bus home. And any of you who are parents of teenagers knows that tainted love is good enough. So I accepted the offer. And I was camp rabbi for the final week of her being at camp. And the camp was gracious enough to extend a special invitation to my wife, Ilana, and to Jacob to come up for Shabbat, which they did. A little more background information. If you have never celebrated Mincha, that is the afternoon service on Shabbat, with USY or Ramah, you have, no offense to the cantors, never really celebrated Mincha. Camp Ramah and USY Far West celebrate Mincha with so much energy, so much ruach, it is chaos and joy distilled into a concentrate and then spilled all over the room. Teenagers are literally jumping over tables, over desks. They're making up songs that they shout at the top of their lungs. And those of you who don't know Camp Ramah yet, the prayer service is held in the BKR, the Beit Knesset Ramah, which is an octagonal building where you close all the doors and windows so the sound simply bounces off of the walls back into the room. It is a cacophony of enormous proportions. You really hear the service not so much with your ears, but with your sternum. And the most special of all the Mincha services is Machon, that last age group. And the most special of the Machon Mincha services is the very last Mincha at camp. So all of the kids, there are about 100 Machonis, they're all gathered inside the Beit Knesset Ramah for this raucous, loud, full of energy service. And Shira's sitting on one of those hard metal benches with her friends. When she gets up and walks out of the BKR and comes over to me and says, "Where's Jacob?" Jacob was walking down by the Chadar Ochel, by the cafeteria. Those of you who know the camp know that's the bottom of the hill is where that is, and Jacob was wandering around. Without saying anything else, after I pointed out where Jacob was, Shira goes and she goes up to her brother and she says, "Come on." And she takes him firmly by the hand and starts dragging him up the hill into the BKR. Those of you who know autistic kids know that noise and chaos are especially challenging for children with autism. Shira held on to her brother. It was clear he didn't have a choice in this. But Jacob held on to his sister with a grin on his face that you could have seen from the other side of camp. And as they walked into the BKR, Shira used one arm to keep hold on her brother, and with the other, she was pushing teenagers aside so that they could go through the noise. And they walked to the far end of the BKR, where her friends were sitting on the bench, and she had them move over, and she sat her brother down, and then she sat down next to him and put her arm around him to help contain his excitement. Jacob was so excited, he kept bouncing out of the bench and bolting for the door. So I stood at the door, and my job was to block the exit and help him go back to his seat. And every time I successfully blocked him and helped Shira bring him back to his seat, Jacob's grin got bigger and bigger and bigger. And looking across the Beit Knesset Ramah in the far wall, I saw Ilana. And her grin was the same grin as Jacob's. And I realized that I had given up on the dream of Jacob being part of the Mincha Machon so long ago that I didn't even remember ever having that dream. And I realized that seeing my two 15-year-olds sitting side by side, watching the other Machon campers, smiling their encouragement to Jacob, smiling their encouragement to Shira, looking at the smiling face of my son, who had achieved a remarkable act of heroism to contain himself to be able to stay in that space for his dear sister. And the heroism of my daughter, who had walked away from her teenage friends to go get her brother so that he could share that moment, I realized, Dayenu, if I died then, it was worth having lived for only that moment. If nothing good ever happens to me for the rest of my life, Dayenu, that moment justifies everything. And I tell you this because we all have Dayenu moments, but we don't always notice them. We don't always give ourselves the gift of seeing the moment. I am not here telling you that everything is always rosy and that you don't have the right to be dissatisfied. Indeed, there are times in our lives where discontent is a mitzvah and where dissatisfaction is the need of the hour. To be tolerant of indifference or laziness or the kind of greed that is clogging and soiling our planet's ability to sustain the symphony of life is not only a mistake, it is a sin. To be selfishly content in a world of injustice and violence and terror and starvation and poverty is a sin. To be smugly satisfied with ourselves as we are and to use that as a reason to abandon working on improving ourselves as we might is a serious error. I think for these reasons the poet Louis Untermeyer prayed, "Ever insurgent let me be, make me more daring than devout, from sleek contentment keep me free, and fill me with a buoyant doubt." I'm not talking about self-congratulatory smugness, but true contentment is not fabricated around deliberately ignoring the pain and the needs of our fellow human beings, nor by accommodating our own faults and shortcomings. True contentment cannot be bought either by dishonesty nor by callousness. In fact, those addictions lead to only greater appetite, to more dire desperation, as the poet Shakespeare, focusing on one of our distracting addictions, commented, "She makes hungry where most she satisfies." Higher contentment is not the reward of hard work. It does not take effort. It bursts upon us as a gift, an act of liberation from the consuming addictions of our ambition, our adulation, our seeking wealth and fame. The story is told of a spiritual seeker who spent his entire life trying one discipline after another, working so hard to beat his soul into the kind of condition where it could finally encounter God. And upon his death, finding himself in the presence of the Holy One, he said, "Ribono shel Olam." Of course, he's a spiritual seeker, so he's Jewish. "Ribono shel Olam, all my life I was running after you. Why did I never find you?" And God said, "Well, to tell you the truth, I was running to catch up, but you run faster than I do." We work so hard for what would be ours if we would simply stand still, simply acknowledge what is already ours as a gift through what our Christian friends call grace, what we call chesed. Those moments of grace are ours simply by being God's children, by being alive. Avraham Abu Lafia in the Chaye HaOlam Haba writes, "Rejoice in what you have and know that God loves you." That love is not the result of a struggle or a striving, but rather of a joyous surrender and acceptance. It is not the prize won by aggression, but a gift received by those open to joy and love. In the words of the great medieval poet and philosopher Shlomo Ibn Gabirol, writing in his Tikkun Midot HaNefesh, "Pri Hahistakfut Hamnucha," the fruit of contentment is tranquility, and the greatest riches are contentment and patience. Can we this year train ourselves to be open to moments of pure chesed, pure love? Can we cultivate hearts of wonder and joy? Can we use that wonder and joy to nurture the relationships that make our lives so full of blessing? Our families, our loved ones, our friends and colleagues and community. Can we discipline our ability to love so that we love freely and forgive freely those whose lives we share? And then I think most challenging of all, can we acknowledge and celebrate our own greatness, love our own beauty? And because we love and acknowledge our own greatness and beauty, you are, I remind you, a reflection of God's image. Can we then have enough superfluous love that we can share it with those that we currently cannot love, those who we ignore, those who we avoid, those who we disdain? The ability to love does not come out of chastisement. It does not come out of fear or anger. It comes out of loving oneself and being rooted in Dayenu, this moment, this blessing. In the words of the poet E.E. Cummings, "I thank you, God, for this most amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees, and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I, who have died today, am alive again today. And this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and wings and of the gay, great, happening, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any lifted from the know of all nothing, human merely being, doubt unimaginable you. Now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened. I bless you in this year, that this should be the year in which the ears of your ears are open, the eyes of your eyes shine, that you are able to so love yourself that you can love your fellows and make then of every moment Dayenu. Shana Tova.